I gave a guitar player in Costa Rica Bitcoin. I still regret it.
You worked at Lehman Brothers. Why don't you tell me about that?
No, I was part of the evil empire, the bad bank.
Yeah, tell us about it. Let me hear about this.
Oh my God. I became a complete maniac. I was I'm a good flow trader. Wall Street was looking for people just like me. I don't have a PhD in math, but I'm awfully good. Investment banking does serve a purpose, and the purpose would be to get capital to companies that are worthy. Of course, it also serves the other purpose, to enrich the investment bankers. And there's a big contest between the two. And I saw both. I saw rapacious, awful greed and things like that. But I also saw as finance some very cool companies. Bitcoin is hard money. It's hard, but it's not credit. I'm a credit guy.
Uh-huh. Right? No doubt.
A lot of Bitcoiners, you know, a lot of them are 100% no fractional reserve, nothing, no credit. And I don't think the world can work that way. Credit starts first, and then business, and then payment. Lehman Brothers was mostly a function of rehypothecation, which is taking the same asset and borrowing against it a whole bunch of times. What Bulla does is it stops that. I used to originate credit for companies. You would have to go to Lehman and pay me a fee for me to originate your own credit. So Bulla, you can do it all on your own. All you have to know is the address of your counterparty.
Down the rabbit hole. Down. Cypherpunk.
Welcome to Cypherpunked, where we explore money's history, crypto's future, and Web3's role in advancing human rights, freedom, and digital liberty. Today's guest is Mike Revy, founder and CEO of Bulla Network, a Wall Street veteran who survived Lehman Brothers, got debanked twice just for paying developers in USDC, and decided the whole system needed to be rebuilt from the ground up. He coded his first business software in high school, became a quant and convertible bond trader at Lehman in the 90s, discovered Bitcoin after the 2008 collapse, and has spent the last 5 years building what he calls the financial primitive for the Web3 revolution. Welcome to the show, my man.
Thanks. It's great to be here. It's my first podcast, too.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. So tell me about yourself, Mike. You, in the 90s, I was barely born, but now I'm here. So,
well, in the 90s, I was midway through. I started when I was a kid. I went to boarding school, and I had a very interesting math teacher who they had just bought a Fortran 77 machine. Yeah, and so I started programming on that.
What is that?
It's just a regular programming language, very early one, Fortran 77. Mm. 1977 is when it first came out.
Wow.
And basically I did a bunch of geometry and, you know, like weird programs for the guy, but that's how I started. And then just one thing led to another. When you're good at tech and business, then you keep getting jobs. So I would always get a job like helping companies figure out. I put a bunch of LANs together, first LANs. I had
local area networks.
Yes. Okay. Local area networks. I did the first FTP sharing board, where I would let people dial up to download a patch to whatever software I was maintaining.
Wow.
I went around town, you know, just modifying people's accounting packages. It was a great business. And then at the same time, I was in college. So I got a linguistics computer science degree.
Okay, wow.
And that was supposed to be, you know, I wanted to write compilers and natural language processing way too early. Now, of course, AI. I did some machine learning really early.
Mm-hmm.
But eventually it dragged me off into Wall Street. Wall Street was looking for people just like me.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have a PhD in math, but I'm awfully good.
Mm-hmm.
And you work at a place like that, and it's littered with all these smarty pants people who have left code on the server, you know, like literally like a model for convertible bonds or, you know, weird options and things like that. So that's how I got started. And
as a side note, what do you think about AI and everything that's happening now, especially with Claude Code and Codex and all these?
It's a small revolution.
It's pretty wild, right?
It's pretty amazing. I grew up thinking Turing completeness kind of determined that a machine can't be self-referential. I don't think it can be self-referential, but it can kind of understand a bit about itself now.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas when I was doing it, that was the hard stop. And now it's kind of a revolution. My peeve with it is, though, it always answers, "Oh, that was a great question."
Yeah.
Like, oh my God.
Yeah, it kind of is built.
Yeah.
Especially OpenAI's models and some of these more, I would say, woke models.
Yeah.
You know, they're just trying to affirm, even if you're totally wrong, it's like, you know,
delusion.
They delusional. Yeah,
delusion.
Confirms your delusions of grandeur.
But what's really powerful about it, and this is what we're doing with Bulla Network, is everything that we have is deployed on a blockchain. It's open source. Mm-hmm. So you can get an AI agent. You can use our entire suite of stuff without the front end now.
Oh, wow.
That's insane.
It's actually pretty cool. And I think that's the... I know a lot of people haven't kind of discussed this, and it hasn't become as a concept. This hasn't been public, but I've been wrapping my brain around. I'm going to make it public right now. Is there's been this whole big, I wouldn't say war, but you know, back and forth with the DeFi community, especially in Web3, about all these DeFi products that you know have front ends that you know the government has an attack surface on the front end, right? Because it's a front end, and you got to keep the website up. Yeah. But now you could. With a couple commands on Claude Code or whatever, you can build your own front end. You don't even need, the Aave or whoever, right?
Yes.
Whatever DeFi protocol. You don't even need that protocol anymore. They don't even need to keep the website up because now you can just operate with the code in the back end.
100%.
So I think this has been a missed point that a lot of people are unaware of, but I've been secretly excited about, which is like, it doesn't matter what these governments say anymore, because if they try to shut down these decentralized protocols, now that there's not even an attack surface on the front end, because you can just make your own front end, which I think is pretty powerful. So in that way,
it gets you around regulation too.
Yeah. Well, that's my point. Yeah.
Yeah. It's because the front end, you can say, well, we're compliant on the front end.
Exactly. Yeah.
But the back end, if an AI agent knows the function.
Yeah. I can just say, hey, take this DeFi protocol, remove the geo-locking, whatever, saying that, you know, remove this, rebuild it, and give it to me, and it'll do it. And at the end of the back end, it's just code.
Yes.
Which, I mean, this is an incredible moment in history and moment in time.
It really is. And it's geometric. It's going to be, you know, the productivity of my devs now has gone from... you know, let's say 20% to it's tripled.
Yeah.
Easily.
No, I've been hearing that a lot. You know, it takes a great developer and makes them an unbelievable developer.
Already
it takes an excellent developer and makes them a god developer.
It does.
And it takes an average, it's a person like myself who barely knows how to do it. And I can build all sorts of stuff now. I'm like, what is going on here? I don't understand what I'm building. I don't understand the hierarchy and the different folders and what's happening and the binaries. I don't understand any of that, but I'm like, hey, I want my Super Mario guy to have a hat, and I want to I want to have kittens that attack. They're the enemies, and I can build all these different things, right? So it's pretty cool.
Yeah, new world out there.
It's a brand new world, from websites to anything. I mean, and it's empowering for everybody on the planet now that you have this access to basically compute that can make you anything you want.
Well, it goes more in the self-sovereign whole idea of Bitcoin.
True,
right?
True.
If you've got a group that knows where to find all the code, all the GitHubs, all the open source, and hook it all together, you can build almost anything.
Yeah.
Quick break. This episode is brought to you by Ledin.
Since 2018, Ledin has originated over $6.5 billion in digital asset loans, all while maintaining a flawless record of zero client asset losses. Our loan book has grown rapidly thanks to our deep understanding of client needs, high-quality service, security, control, and flexibility. This client-centric approach has enabled us to provide loans to clients in over 120 countries while maintaining a strong reputation for trust and reliability. Our approach is rooted in resilience and responsibility. We've weathered industry cycles and remain steadfast in our commitment to best-in-class security, compliance, and innovation. We were the first digital asset lender to complete a proof of reserves attestation with an independent CPA. And we've repeated this process every 6 months to ensure accountability to our clients. Emerging from the 2022 credit crisis, we've vowed to build the industry responsibly. Ledin is now profitable, growing, and backed by leading venture firms, including Coinbase, White Star Capital, 10T Holdings, and Kingsway Capital. Recently, we completed the industry's first Bitcoin-backed syndicated loan with Sygnum Bank, and we also received an A- equivalent rating for our Bitcoin-backed loans. In addition, we've obtained registration and regulatory approval as a virtual asset service provider from the Cayman Islands Monetary Authority, and have achieved SOC 2 Type 2 certification, ensuring that security and trust are at the core of everything we do. Whether you're looking to unlock liquidity or diversify your portfolio, Ledin is here to support your financial goals. Reach out to our team today to learn how we can help you build your digital wealth. Ledin, digital assets, done right.
And now back to the show.
Do you use Claude Code specifically, or which code?
I use OpenClaw. I just
did. Oh, so you're doing, have you done an OpenClaw build?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Really? I was building one out there. I don't know if you saw it when you were going in.
I didn't. No.
Oh, you didn't see it?
No, but I'll have a look.
We're building a computer and we're going to make an OpenClaw agent.
Oh, my gosh. So, yeah. Wow.
So maybe when you get out, you can give us some pointers.
Well, I've just started. No, I'm not a super expert, but I make a do stuff, just dumb things that, you know, you always, let me just. Like my daily routine when I was a bond trader was, okay, I need to look at the Merrill Lynch, spread. What's the high yield spread doing today? Mm-hmm. And if I had been out for the weekend and it was a rough one in New York, Monday, I'd kind of forget where I had to go. What was the website? Where is OpenClaw? You program it once, you give it a skill and...
Yeah, it just does, it executes, it gives you information, et cetera.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, and I'm also very displeased at how the whole crash in the software market is all based on, oh my God, nobody's going to have a job anymore, right? I think that's BS.
I agree with you.
Yeah. You're going to be able to educate yourself at twice the speed.
There you go.
And be much more productive.
Yeah.
So like, whereas before, and I can give you concrete examples, I've been trying to start a pool and stuff on chain. Mm-hmm. I'm very far along, but
what are you trying to do? Start a what?
Start a pool, like a lending pool.
I have a lending pool. Okay.
But it's my own. It's like insider money. It's not open to the public.
So yeah, you want to make like an aggregated.
Yeah. What do I have to do? Yeah. What kinds of things do I have to find? So
kind of like what Aave does. And
but for RWA. Which would mean
real world assets.
They are, and they're managed. So that's different. That's a Howey test. That's a security.
Yeah, there's a lot there.
So, but you can ask AI all the legal questions to your heart's delight.
For sure.
And figure it out. And then go to the lawyer for the final, rundown. But at least you know what the topology is of the problem you're trying to attack. Whereas before,
you had no idea.
And if you ask somebody, it costs you, four grand.
Yeah, right? Yeah, you're not
before
wrong.
Before you knew.
So. Put the 5K retainer down, big dog.
Exactly. Mike, you put your 5K retainer down, has your lawyer called you back? No, it's really busy.
Yeah.
I haven't heard from him.
Oh, man. Hey, that idea that you mentioned, I think with people being able to do more as the cost of these things and the access comes up, the cost comes down. Paul, can you look up something called Jevons Paradox? Is it called Jevons Paradox? I'm trying to remember the name of it. It's this idea that everyone's like, oh, now everyone's going to lose their job and everyone's not going to be able to do anything. And when in the history of humanity has that ever happened when we've had technological breakthroughs?
Yes.
Whether it's the car, whether it's the personal computer, whether it's the phone, whatever it is throughout human history, whether it's the mills that make t-shirts and stuff, the machines that do that, right? The Luddites. I mean, every time in human history, where we've had a technological breakthrough, on the back end of it, way more jobs are created, more specializations, more possibilities. There's going to be jobs that people have never even heard of. There always is, right? Like before you had cars, was there a job where someone could be a mechanic? Was there a job where you'd make engines? Was there a job where you made wheels or pistons? You know what I mean? Like none of those jobs existed and you created. Yes, you probably lost a couple jobs of people who took care of the horses or whatever, but you gained way more, right?
I think as long as the change is not too sudden, humanity adapts.
That is true. And that, I guess that would be the one concern because this change is happening very suddenly.
Really fast.
But but that being said, the internet and all these other technologies were also, there was early adopters, but this is the idea.
Oh, right? Jevons. Yeah.
It's called Jevons Paradox.
Yeah, cool.
Is the observation that technological improvements that increase the efficiency of resource use often lead to an overall increase in the consumption of that resource. Go up a little bit, Paul. The resource rather than a decrease. So the paradox named after the English economist William Stanley Jevons, who described it in his 1865 book, The Coal Question. Jevons noticed that as steam engines became more efficient using less coal per unit of work, total coal consumption in Britain exploded instead of falling. The improved efficiency made coal-powered machinery cheaper to run, which encouraged more widespread adoption of steam engines, new industries and applications that previously weren't economical, higher overall production and economic growth. And I guess what I'll close out with is this has happened with whether it comes to hard drive space on our computers with like all the, you know, they're happening with GPUs and compute and all this other stuff. If the price comes down, guess what? There will be even more because more people will be able to enter and create jobs and do all these things. So I guess I'm spinning the techno optimist manifesto here.
Well, yeah, you know, I am an optimist. You have to be an optimist.
No doubt.
In the world. So
no doubt about it.
The only bitterness I have is that my GPUs are not, you know, profitable mining Bitcoin any longer.
That is very sad. It was a sad day for me many years ago, but I've adapted and got a lot of Bitcoin ASICs and I repurposed my GPUs to other things. And
nice.
Now, you know, some of my GPUs are spinning up a model that we're running and doing all sorts of stuff, doing this large language stuff. So
you notice things walking in.
Yeah, this is a fun place to be. This is like, there's not much of a tech hub here in Naples, Florida, but this is the tech little hub here. I have all of my tech guys and I said, hey, you guys get free access. You come and do experiments, build things, you know, I'll finance different projects. We can, you know, my son, he's learning a lot. So it's been awesome. It's been awesome. So let's go back to you, Mike. Tell me about your, you know, I guess it's kind of a cool perspective. You worked at Lehman Brothers. Why don't you tell me about that?
No, I was part of the evil, you know, the evil empire, the bad bank.
Yeah, tell us about, let me hear about this.
Oh my God, you know, investment banking does serve a purpose, and the purpose would be to get capital to companies that are worthy. Mm-hmm. Of course, it also serves the other purpose to enrich the investment bankers. And there's a big, you know, like contest between the two. And I saw both. I saw, you know, rapacious, awful greed and, you know, things like that. But I also saw us finance some very cool companies.
Can you tell me what, can you explain what investment banking is for our listeners?
Oh, investment banking is...
What's the difference between regular banking and investment banking? Because there's an important distinction.
Yeah, what an investment bank does is they raise capital for your business and then they sell equity or bonds to the public. So what they'll do is they'll say, well, you've got Tesla and you have, let's say, $100 million in sales. You want to get a bunch of capital so you can get another three or four factories. Well, what are you going to do? You're going to go to an investment bank. And an investment bank knows all the people who are on what's called the buy side. Mm-hmm. And the buy side are people like Franklin, Templeton, Vanguard, you know, people like that. And what they do is they cultivate relationships with those people and say, well, next week we're coming with a new issue, Tesla. It's, you know, awesome company. It's got growth, revenue growth of X. It's got margins of Y. You got to be in on this. We're, you know, the pricing in the equity is going to be between, you know, what an IPO is, right?
Yeah, initial public offering.
So that's what an investment bank does. They also do it on the debt side as well. And the most interesting part in an investment bank, if any investment bankers are out there, is convertible bonds. That's where I was because it's both. You are doing an equity around inside of a bond. Mm-hmm. So it's a totally different structure. And the companies that do convertibles, you should be looking at because they have what I call passive alpha. They understand the insider. Remember, information is asymmetric.
Yeah.
If I'm working at the company, I'm going to know a lot more than you do.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? Mm-hmm. So if I'm going to finance my company at an investment bank and I choose to do debt, I choose to do equity, or I choose to do convertibles, those signal three very different things.
Explain that, unpack that. That's actually really interesting. In my mind, I would think if you just want to do debt, you don't want to give up equity, so you're bullish on your company.
100%. So you should, people who issue debt, straight debt, probably can buy it. Of course, they're going to be sleepy companies that pay a dividend. The ones that issue equity, that's going to be expensive. They don't see a lot of upside, or they're desperate. Mm-hmm. Convertible, what it is it's a bond that can mature for the same amount as a bond. So you buy $1,000 in bonds, you can get your $1,000 back in, let's say, 5 years.
Okay.
But inside of that bond is an option that says you can buy equity at $30 a share. When they issue the convertible, it's only at 15, let's say, $20 a share. Okay. So you can convert. And the idea, the insiders, what they're telling you is we are willing to risk giving investors a put on our assets and our business in exchange for a lower coupon on the convertible, but we get to sell equity a little bit higher.
Okay. Okay.
So they're saying our equity is cheap, and you should pile in.
Okay.
Get a coupon while you wait, and we will prove it to you.
Okay. Interesting.
So that's
interesting.
Yeah.
So when do companies? I mean, what size company do you have to be to start to tap this market? And how does that even work? Do you just walk
well, usually a bank, it goes
investment bank and talk to them.
Talk to an investment bank. Usually, it starts with if you're very small, they'll start with a really small. You know, investment banks like I can't think of any, right? Jefferies, I guess, or somebody small. And what they'll do is they'll always do an equity issue at the beginning.
Okay.
And usually that's expensive, but the idea is you want to leg into more, you know, you want a relationship, you like the business, and you're not that concerned about, you know, eighths and tenths or tens and twenties, right?
What does that mean? Eighths and tenths and tens and twenties.
Well, you as an investor on the buy side really like the sector. Like if somebody came to you and said Palantir is a new company and they're just raising equity, and you would look at the valuation and go, wow, that's really rich. But I want to be in. I want to get a toehold. I want to commit to it. What that means is that later the investment bank remembers you were in, even at a scary price. And so subsequent rounds, you're probably in. That's how it works in investment banking. They remember.
Okay.
There's memory.
I got you. So you would come in.
You'd come in very early with equity. You'd stick with the company and the investment bank. And,
you're saying from the buy side, that would just be really risky, I guess. Is that the idea?
At the beginning, but it's small numbers. It's like.
Like how much?
Well, let's say. Anytime you manage a portfolio, you should never have more than a 1% position unless you really know something, right? Okay. So either you are in a big index fund like, you know, Franklin, where it's 1% or the highway, or you're a very specialized buy-sider that knows something about AI, whose specialty is, and they will have lumpy positions, you know, like a 15, 10% position.
Okay.
But they know, they have done the research, they know that analysts, they know the bankers. That's where, and they're trying to get alpha, you know, versus the market. So that's where you would want to position yourself with these early guys. And then later, only after you've done the equity a few times, then you do a convert.
Okay.
And then you do, then you hope you do a straight bond, you know, because right now we're just minting money.
Okay.
Yeah.
When you say you hope you do a straight bond, are you talking about from the investor's side or from the
company?
The company side, right? Yeah. Because at the end, they don't want to give up equity.
No.
You really don't want to give. I mean, that's how I feel. I mean, it's not great unless
it's the last thing you want.
Unless you got good partners. I mean, that's like, I want to, if I give up equity, I'm like, I want somebody who's in this with me.
100%.
That really believes in the product and the vision and wants to be a part of this thing.
Yep.
Yeah. That's okay. Very interesting. So you were in that final stage, that convertible bond aspect of things, where it's not just debt, it's not just equity, it's that convertible bond. And what was your experience like? Did you leave before the whole thing blew up, or were you there when it blew up?
I was a trader. I was a maniac. You know, I got transferred. What happened was another thing about investment banks is they poach talent from each other all the time.
Oh wow!
Right. So in the beginning, I was just a tech guy, you know, and I found a couple of models. I hooked it up to a database of terms. This is before Bloomberg. And, you know, then I started plowing stuff through the model and giving them a risk report. And I know Lehman is famous for risk reports, so I shouldn't tout that too much, but right. It was one of the first risk reports. Anyway, I was literally at the desk talking to, one of the head preferred trader and out comes the head of trading goes, you know, we, so-and-so got pinched there at Deutsche Bank. You effing know this shit, Reeby. You are trading. And literally, first, and I remember, what was the name? I forget the name. I think it was Halliburton had earnings or something, and they had a zero bond. And the head of sales stands up, Reeby, what's your market in Halliburton? I had no idea they had earnings. So I looked at the mark, you know, and made a spread around the mark and got hit right away in like size. And then she stood up to her credit and said, you keep trading. Don't, you know, because trading is about being in the flow.
Yeah.
It's not about, you know, count your shekels later.
Yeah.
But stay in the flow. So of course my next, you know, bid was much lower. I'm on the offer, you know, right. And then I just started trading and I became a complete maniac. I was a I'm a good flow trader.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
Weirdly.
So how much, so like when they started you out, how much capital did they give you? What was your?
No, it was, well, in New York, it's different. I started in New York and there's, you know, it's like, well, at the time, 10 million or so per trader. And then in London, it's smaller because there are smaller issues. So like, you know, if your book at the end of the day was more than 1.5 million, they might be like, hey, why are you? Because I was supposed to be a market maker. I was not there. We had proprietary trading too, which is different. That's where you take a position. That's where you, you know, you arbitrage stuff, let's say between cap, between bond, whatever. But I was a market maker. And the objective of a market maker is just like in an AMM now, is to make the maker taker.
Okay, you know, gotcha. Make a spread. To connect the buyer and the seller. Yeah. Take the little fee.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And not get too maimed and killed in between.
But so, wow, that's super interesting. So like, how many trades did you do on any given day?
Oh, well, some days I'd play chess, like Yahoo chess, you know, some days were really slow.
Yeah.
But when we had new issues.
What does that mean, new issues?
New issues. So the investment bank, like I was saying earlier, has now Thermodynamics is coming out with a new convertible bond. We're placing it tomorrow. And here is the allocation, and so-and-so, these people are going to be really upset because they allocated for 5 million. They got one.
Okay.
And these other people would be really happy, but we only gave them 250 or 500. So what you're supposed to do, the sales guys are supposed to call up, hey, Thermo, Mike, where's Thermo trading? I'd be 101 to a quarter. What do you want to do? You know, buy 2 million, sold to you at a quarter. And then I would just move the market up and down around it. But a new issue, we would trade probably, I mean, could be 10, 15 million bucks, you know, easily.
Interesting.
At the time. I'm sure it's bigger now.
Actually. Wow. That's fascinating. Yeah. So what happened with the fallout at Lehman? Were you still there when all that?
I was not. I had moved on to the buy side. I still had equity, but I was at the buy side. And again, that's Lehman Brothers, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, all those people are called sell side. And because they manufacture the equity and the bonds and they sell it
to the public,
to the buy side,
or to the buyers, investors. Yeah.
So I moved to the buy side and I managed a convertible portfolio. I did the research for about we managed $4 billion in converts for a while.
Oh, wow.
With me and my sister and a bunch of, you know, some other PMs. And then, when Lehman blew up, it affected me quite a bit. I had a hedge fund, and I had a prime broker account at Lehman that I couldn't get out of.
Really?
Yeah. So I was a creditor.
Oh.
So I got frozen. First bid was 20 cents on a pretty big number.
Wow.
Eventually it paid 100, but that was 8 years later, years later.
So did you just sit on it, or did you take a bid at some point on that?
We sat on most of it. You know, some investors wanted out.
Yeah.
Okay. I facilitated a few to get out. It wasn't a huge fund or anything. It's not, the $4 billion was safe.
Yeah.
This was a hedge fund that we had started.
On the side.
Okay. And it was small, so it wasn't that bad, but... we just sat on it. I watched those claims trade.
Wow.
Every, you know, couple of days they would trade. It's a whole nother universe that you didn't know about either.
Yeah. These
recovery people.
Yeah, no, I mean, the only experience I ever have had with any of this would be like BlockFi or some of these things that got frozen. It's like you get paid out a little bit or something.
People were buying those claims, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's
the... Sell those claims and stuff happen. And, Yeah, that's the only thing I've ever seen anything like that.
And the fallout, really, what it did to me, though, Lehman, it just made me realize it's politics, government, money, fiat, you know, the state. I mean, Bear Stearns should have gone under before Lehman.
Yeah.
And J.P. Morgan.
Tell me about that.
Well, J.P. Morgan didn't like, you know, Dick Fuld at Lehman Brothers. That basically, that's the scuttlebutt I've heard. I don't really know.
Yeah.
And Lehman had started to if you're an investment bank, you want to stay nimble. You don't want to commit your capital to anything. And Lehman had committed to, I think, some real estate. So they had some like things that they couldn't sell that weren't liquid. And when you can't do what's called a repo and take collateral and get money overnight, when that becomes problematic, then of course you have to rely on your own capital. And that was what was happening in 2008. People started to not trust the capital that was being provided. Mm-hmm. And then the whole thing blew up. I think Lehman, it was insolvent. It wasn't really bankrupt because the claims I had later were 100 cents.
Yeah. So similar, I guess, to this whole thing with what's the other bank that just went? Silvergate.
Was it Silvergate? Yeah.
Was it Silicon Valley Bank? That was another one. That was
SVB, First Republic.
Yeah. Where they basically had these bonds that were, you know,
in all actuality,
if you hold them to term, they pay out, you know, 1% interest at the end of the day, but there's no liquidity, right?
No.
So you got this completely, like, you know, it just blows my mind. The government mandates them to have that shit, that garbage on the balance sheet.
Yeah.
You have zero liquidity. You have some liquidity because the bond traders, right? But like, you know, you don't get parity liquidity. You have, you know, you get a 1% upside return on this.
Yeah.
So like you're taking all this risk for what? For 1% over however many years? I mean, the whole thing is just absolutely absurd.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we can get into banking if you want. Yeah. To me, FDIC is absurd. I mean, you pay the same price for bank insurance. Every bank does. Think about that. Like FDIC doesn't really distinguish between JP Morgan and Silicon
Valley. I don't think there's actually they don't have like some insurance reserve sitting somewhere. They just, you know, print the money if something happens or whatever.
That's right.
Inflate everybody away. I mean, that's.
But they give it to everybody too at no cost, right? Or at the cost of being regulated.
Yeah.
So you have to have the proper ratios.
Yep.
But the problem with that is then who is God? Who knows what the right ratios should be?
It's the communist board. Don't you know this? The most important good of all society, which is money. We got to have a communist board for this.
That's
good.
That's right.
Because communism works so
thinking?
Well.
What was I thinking?
Historically, I mean, just look at the history. I mean, communism works so well. So for the most important good in all of society, money itself.
Yeah,
we just got to have. I mean,
we just don't want more.
Yeah, we just got to print more and just let these guys decide, right?
Yeah, and give them free insurance.
They've got this $4 billion palace they're working on in DC. Don't you know about it? There's like, I think the average salary is $300,000 a year
isn't
for each top.
Is that the top?
Yeah, I mean, it's like, come on, we need like, what do they have? Like five? They have like 200. What is it? Like 20,000 employees or something at the Fed? I don't know. I mean, I'm exaggerating.
Is it that many? Really?
I don't know. It's getting up there. It's turning into a nice DEI for PhDs.
Well, you know, they don't have all the economic people there.
Paul, why don't you look that up? How many employees does the Federal Reserve have in total spread around?
Versus like USDT.
Yeah. They have like 30 guys.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, man. What a good business. But yeah, I mean, you know, this idea of money being political, that was kind of like when you first thought about it and you're like,
oh, yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
And it's not.
I mean, this is insane. They have,
24,000 people.
They have 24,000
And look at Tether.
People.
Yeah, you did the comparison.
Yeah, there it is.
Comparison.
I mean, that is unbelievable. There are 24,000. I mean, this is the problem with bureaucracy and stuff.
Yeah,
I mean,
it's
like, you know, totally absurd. I mean, you could have a monkey pressing buttons probably do a better job, I think, personally. Yeah. I mean, but the whole premise is ridiculous. When you realize that money is the lifeblood of society, it needs to flow. It's constantly sending signals about, you know, hey, what goods are important in society, right? It's sending this price signal. And we have this communist board that is constantly interfering and manipulating this thing. And, you know, it's like, could you imagine if we did that for any other good? Everybody would laugh and say this is absurd. So why do we do it for the most important good in all of society, which is money? There's no justification in my mind or reason.
Well, it's taxes.
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy. Well, it does allow them to manipulate the supply and do all this stuff. And, you know, they collect taxes, but they also print money. I mean, it's like when people fully realize how bad they're getting fleeced, I mean, you know, that's the problem. Nobody has any idea.
Hence Bitcoin.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's why Bitcoin is the best performing asset in all of human history. Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, since inception, it's gone up something like 5,000,000% or something like that, you know.
I bought one and I had to go. I was living in Switzerland.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was 2011, and I had to go to this weird, like, cafe in the back of, like, the bad part of town in Zurich to a little ATM machine, and it didn't even take a card. You had to feed it 1,000 francs or 500 franc note, and then it would print out the private key.
Oh, wow.
And then you had to go rush back and, like, you know, type it in and drain the little mini wallet they gave you.
Oh, that's too funny. Oh, so Bulla Network. Tell me about Bulla and how you got involved in, you know, Bitcoin, crypto. Where did you, after Lehman, after your hedge fund, after the hedge fund kind of got frozen with your accounts and all that, how did you transition over to being involved in Bitcoin and crypto? And what's your story on that front?
Well, like I said, I bought a Bitcoin a little late, you know, 2008-09 was Lehman. And then I kept moving around. I'm half Swiss, so I was living in Switzerland and then the US. And every time I moved somewhere else, the Bitcoin was still there.
Yeah. Isn't that cool?
It's amazing.
Borderless, global, and decentralized.
Yeah. Private. And I had a bank account. I had bank accounts in both countries, of course, and none of them could speak to each other. I even had like a Facebook account that would blow up because it was on the wrong server, you know, stuff like that. Whoa. Bitcoin, always there, always working. And it just started kind of percolating in my mind, like, oh my God, this is something that can't be manipulated, is always there, doesn't matter where you are. Mm-hmm. And then back to my background, credit. And I financed a lot of things. I built like a lot of apartments and, you know, I financed it. I ran a business in Switzerland. It was manufacturing. And so I understood working capital and how hard it is to get working capital.
Oh, yeah. And, it's very difficult.
Right. And even if you can demonstrate that you have purchase orders, people can fake those things. And I started thinking about, well, you can't fake Bitcoin. It's always, it's that same address.
Yeah.
And so I started thinking about what is business? I started thinking about it deeper than, mm-hmm. right? I mean, most people don't have time to think about these things, but mm-hmm. I realized credit starts first and then business and then payment. So yeah, you go buy a newspaper for a dollar and you hand them the dollar. Mm-hmm. That's not business. That's not the business I'm talking about. That guy had to have made an order for X number of newspapers. Mm-hmm. And when they got delivered, he then paid back the newspaper guy, right? So that's what I'm talking about. And I thought to myself, oh my gosh, this is a great opportunity to demonstrate that you have a credit against somebody. And remember, Lehman Brothers was mostly a function of rehypothecation, which is lending, you know, relending or taking the same asset and borrowing against it a whole bunch of times.
I mean, that's pretty much the crux of the entire system.
Exactly. And what this does, what Bulla does, is it stops that. And it gives you the power. So I can personally, or your business can personally originate your own credit. Remember, I worked in an investment bank. I used to originate credit for companies, mm-hmm. right? So you would have to go to Lehman and pay me a fee mm-hmm. for me to originate your own credit. Mm-hmm. So Bulla, you can do it all on your own. All you have to know is the address of your counterparty. And you say, and Bulla, the meaning of Bulla is from Sumerian.
I'm really into that stuff.
It's a stamp. It means a stamp. And you're signing with your wallet. If you're signing, you know, false claims, then it will catch up with you. Mm-hmm. But if you're signing real ones against other parties, then the veracity becomes truer and truer. And as that grows, the opportunity to finance comes along with it. So Bulla is two things. It lets you do simple claims like an invoice, a purchase order. It even does friend lends. We call them friend lends, like a P2P mm-hmm. loan. And those are tokens, they're NFTs. So it's like we're taking the Bored Ape idea and applying it to business. And then that Bored Ape can be financed in a pool, and we have pool contracts. So it's 100% pool. There is no way for me or anybody else to hide the peas in a pool, right? And the pool knows that has an underwriter that is designated the address. That underwriter can determine who deposits, white lists, and who gets credit. And then it also determines what kind of target yield am I going to offer my depositors mm-hmm. and what kind of fees and, you know, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. So what the best application now is this trucking company that is working with me, TCS. I think you've spoken to Todd once before. Mm-hmm. So he's my biggest customer.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. And so what he's doing is he's getting bill of ladings from trucking companies, and we are then minting those so that everybody can see it on a blockchain. Mm-hmm. And then we are financing it in a pool where depositors can see the state of every invoice that mm-hmm. Todd has financed. So is it late? When did it get paid? Mm-hmm. You know, at what rate? Didn't, because the target yield will float. Did it, is there, we will add UCC filing soon. I don't know if you know what that is.
UCC filing, yeah.
Yeah. So it's, it takes the Bitcoin or the, you know, blockchain, permissionless and non-changeable elements. And it makes credit that much more financeable, because right now, look at what's happening: Blue Owl, Morgan Stanley's private credit fund. Mm-hmm. What's the other? Cliff Water. They're all blowing up. Right?
There's a big problem going on right now.
Yeah, with private credit markets. And it's probably, like you said, 100 cents at the end of the day, or 98, mm-hmm. but nobody knows.
Yeah,
and nobody can prove it. You look at the pool that we have on Bulla, you can see.
That's the beautiful part about being on the blockchain. I mean, it's completely transparent.
Yes, you can see it all. So there would be no, there can still be a panic.
Yeah.
Because you need liquidity and you.
There's no dark pool.
Exactly.
You know, it's not
there's
dark,
no rehypothecated at some, other bank. So that's the idea behind Bulla. It's really to get business on chain using the blockchain, because it's such a, it's going to bring down the cost of capital. It's going to also improve the auditability and
auditability is key. Yeah,
unbelievable. Like because I send you a invoice and I put you as the debtor mm-hmm. on my little NFT. Mm-hmm. You load up Bulla with your wallet. It sees debtor and it says payable, and it puts it in the little payable mm-hmm. folder. Right,
yeah.
On my side, I'm seeing receivable. We are working. We are doing each other's books.
Uh-huh.
At the same time.
Yeah, it's awesome.
I mean, it's really pretty revolutionary in me.
So Bulla can be used for many different things. I know Todd was using it for TCS.
Yeah.
And how's that going? Is he live with that? Has he put a lot of stuff on chain yet?
He's we're trying to get the buy side to come.
Uh-huh.
For
education is
key. Huge.
It's like you're the chicken and the egg problem.
And
right?
The stable tokens have only been persona grata. Mm-hmm. How long?
Since Trump's been elected.
So not very long. I know. Long, it feels like it's been a long time.
Yeah, there's still all sorts of fun and stuff out there.
Yeah.
People talking.
But like when we started and when you spoke to him, I'm mm-hmm. pretty sure Deloitte would not sign off on stable tokens on a balance sheet.
Uh-huh.
They'd be like, what's this funny crypto
stuff,
right? Now I think there are more accepted.
Mm-hmm.
And because there'll be the Clarity Act genius thing, there'll be regulation. You will know that Circle or DT or whatever has to do proof of reserve, blah, blah, blah. These are, so stable tokens mm-hmm. are the first step to really getting somebody like Todd mm-hmm. and the buy side comfortable. And so he's talking to a couple of big buy side people mm-hmm. who are very interested, but their timing is, they're slow. So,
yeah.
But the pool has grown. It's doubled. Actually, it's tripled since I spoke to John, I think a year
now. Do you have, is it a separate pool for TCS and then a separate pool for other things?
Yes.
So they have their own pool specifically for that one use case.
Yes.
Which is the truckers getting receivables quickly.
Yes.
How, because I know the whole thing that that Todd was telling me was like, the way it happens now is you have to wait 3 months and to get paid, and then there's all this, and if you want to get paid right now, it's it's almost like exploitative how much they charge you an interest for that 3 month period or whatever.
Yeah, right now what happens is you have to have an agreement with somebody, and that agreement then you are beholden to whatever terms they dictate. Mm-hmm. Of course. There is only one pool on Bulla. There could be others, but you're still quasi siloed with Bulla. But at least with Bulla, there is more public disclosure about what kind of rates people are being charged.
Uh-huh.
Whereas in the traditional world, that's not necessarily the case.
Of course.
And the other thing about the traditional world, and this is finance like this is older than the Sumerians, basically, or as old.
Mm-hmm.
So it's nothing new that we're doing. It's just we are bringing the transparency, auditability, and price discovery to mm-hmm. the whole industry. Mm-hmm. And that's really going to change things. And I think these other factors, they're going to wake up. They're going to be, oh my gosh, this is something we should be doing too. We should be tokenizing stuff. Mm-hmm. They haven't until now, because a lot of times the barbarian who is going to, you know, disintermediate things doesn't come from the industry within, right? Mm-hmm. Because you're just eating yourself.
Yeah.
So I think there's a bit of that. But then back to adoption, stable tokens are now recognized. So it's really just a function of the legal that's left. And I could talk about that, you know, the AI and legal, but that's the last hurdle.
Okay. Interesting. Tell me more about this 5,000-year-old Sumerian clay stamp. I want to go down that rabbit hole. I love talking about the history of money.
Well, it's a great story because, okay, imagine you don't want to go to a market with all of your herd of sheep.
Yep.
Okay. So what do? You go with a couple of samples. Just like when you go to the Colorado Rodeo, you bring a couple of prize bulls and, you know, you guarantee that generally speaking, all the other ones look the same. And the buyer comes and he says, well, I want three of those and five of these and six of those. And well, how do you settle? You go to the priest. He has a stamp. Everybody knows the priest, knows that he has a stamp. Mm-hmm. And he says, okay, you know, you have committed to buying five sheep at, you know, $100 a piece, and he stamps it. And then you can go to the farm and pick it up because it has a bulla on it. It has a stamp on it. Mm. The other thing about bulla, the reason I know about it is not because of Sumeria, but because my mom would read to me before school. Mm-hmm. And I loved Henry VIII was to me very fascinating.
Was that the guy who killed all his wives?
Yes.
Their heads,
yes.
He wouldn't give him a.
And he was excommunicated by papal bull.
Oh.
So a document came and it was stamped by the Pope.
Gotcha.
Saying you are a bad boy. So that's the idea with bulla. And it you see how it works with a wallet, right? It's a signature. So if like TCS, they have one wallet that does the financing. If that wallet is signing things, mm-hmm. you know, they're, unless they're hacked, but right. You know, they're money good.
Yeah. Interesting. Tell me about this PayPal integration you guys are working on.
PayPal is, it's a validation of what we're doing. Mm-hmm. What we have, or what Todd has now, is a mint function. Along with, we get some NIM, we earn some interest if we have balances in PayPal. The other thing about PayPal is it's very well known with truckers. It's something a lot of people don't know. Like, they don't know what USDC is, and they certainly don't know what DT is.
Yeah.
But PayPal, they're familiar with.
Yeah.
And so it's a natural fit for us to finance freight with using PayPal. And I think it's going to grow into a lot of other, you know, products for trucking and truck related stuff. But essentially, we now have a mint function where we cut our costs. Before, we were buying USDC or DT and, mm-hmm. you know, paying 20 bips or 10 bips. Okay. Now it's zero.
And you get interest.
Yeah. Yeah.
So is PayPal sharing that interest with you? How's that? Are they?
No, they're very aggressive. They want to expand. They want to grow their, you know, their number, what are they, number 10 or 8? I don't know.
Stablecoin charts.
They want to grow their TVL. They want to grow their TVL.
Interesting. What do you think is the next big use case for this, for what you're building? You know, credit unions, healthcare, government billing, all sorts of different random things.
Wow. Like,
what are you most excited about?
Well, I've been accepted into a plug and play. I don't know if you know.
No.
So they're a Silicon Valley accelerator. Very high end. They did, you know, Dropbox, and I think they might have done Google. I can't remember. So we're going to be deploying on XDC, which is another blockchain, mm-hmm. has super high TPS, which is something I'm worried about with even trucking, because trucking could be 10,000 invoices a day, mm-hmm. and you know, you start plowing that through mainnet, and right, things might get a little slow.
You're talking about when you talk about mainnet, are you talking about
Ethereum mainnet?
Okay,
yeah.
Ethereum mainnet. Okay.
I mean, I think it can still handle it, but you know, that's one of the reasons why I like XDC. Mm-hmm. And XDC is trying to position themselves in global trade and trade finance. So I'm have a partnership with another logistics company, shipping.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Really cool software that shows you know, the it'll open a map like where is all my freight today?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and like here we'd see our boats.
Yeah.
You know,
boats going across the Atlantic or whatever. Yeah.
And hopefully our wallet, you know, increasing, right? But that's the idea of what we're gonna do. Freight is our next hurdle. It's really interesting. Return 12% to 15%.
Okay.
Versus Todd is, you know, 8%. Yeah. Todd is that much more. It's 30-day AAA. This freight has a lot of other.
Well, look at what's going on in the world right now. Yeah, I mean, you can explain some
straight through this, Hormuz,
the Strait of Hormuz, and all the dynamic down in the Red Sea they're talking about. So, you know, there's a lot more variables there. There's
what's great too is our pool has an element of insurance, so we can add an insurance fee. Mm-hmm. We have an address in there that can be the insurer.
Okay,
we have
that's actually really interesting.
Yeah, that's another business.
That is super interesting.
Yeah,
what you just mentioned, because you know, an insurance provider could come in and say. They could do run their own metrics and evaluations, and then you know, instead of paying 12%, you pay 13.5%, but you're insured, and that extra 1% goes to the insurance pool, and it's all automated and done on chain.
You got it.
It's incredible. It's a beautiful thing, and then everybody knows. You know, there's no question. Like, are they underinsured? Or are they overinsured?
Yeah.
You can look and see the blockchain and look at the wallets and be like, okay, this makes sense. You know, here's the risk. Here's what profit they're making, and they can adjust that up and down in real time.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's.
Yeah. It will bring efficiencies that we
what a wonderful imagine. World. Yeah, everyone's so doom and gloom about everything, but the possibilities are
no. What's
endless.
Wrong with everybody?
Yeah, it's I know.
Like the bear. I know. It's too many bears around.
It's because yeah, I mean, it's the negative energy just sells. Oh, you know, that's why the news does. Is so negative.
Well, you always sound smarter when you're negative, right? Like if you're a dumb bull, you're like, yeah, I just think it's great. I'm gonna buy.
Oh,
it.
Oh man. So let's transition over to talk about what's happening in the world right now. What are your thoughts, Mike? Where do you see everything playing out over the next couple of years here? You know, obviously there's been so much happening with this situation in Iran and the Strait of Hormuz and, you know, oil prices going up and all this stuff. Like, how do you see this playing out? What are your thoughts and opinions?
I think we're draining the global swamp.
Yeah.
I think there's been an enormous amount of fraud.
It's unbelievable.
In every country.
Yeah.
Including the Middle East. And I think in the worst part about the Middle East, they've been financing, you know, terror, doing bad things. Yeah. But even in this country, oh my gosh.
Oh my, have you seen this, what's his name? The guy who's been going around and just
Nick
Shirley.
Nick Shirley.
That guy's unbelievable.
Awesome. I mean,
it's like, you just see this stuff. It's like, there's 100, you know, hospice centers in here and you got these.
And there's nobody there.
Yeah, there's nobody there. They're rolling in with the high-end BMWs and whatever, the Mercedes vans and stuff. It's like, we are literally like, this is what our tax dollars are going for. I mean, this is unbelievable. The fraud and abuse that these people get away with. I mean, and this is part of the downfall of having a very centralized monetary system where they can press a button and print trillions of dollars out of thin air. And they just can just abuse all the populace and take from productive people.
Yeah.
And then you get this situation where we're at this part of the empire where, you know, the ancient Rome got here, other empires got here. It's like, now it's kind of like this moment where it's like, are we going to fix this shit? Or, you know, are we going to transition? Something like Bitcoin is a tool for people to kind of escape the system a little bit.
100%,
but, you know, we've this cannot go on. This game cannot continue on that front.
Well, not with our current monetary
system.
I don't think it's, you know, it's we can't, the amount of debt that we have, I don't think we can grow the economy a bit fast enough to pay it all off.
I think we can if we stop the fraud.
Oh, well, maybe.
But the fraud is like unbelievable. I mean, like, you just see this, and it's like, imagine. You go to one county in one little city and you just see the breadth of the money that's being stolen. It's like, and that's stolen from taxpayers and, like, you know, people just like put their head in the sand, like, you know, and they're like, oh, this isn't happening. Like, this is happening right in front of your eyes. Are you, you know, look, you know,
I mean, and how many times has the Fed failed their audit?
Yeah. I don't think, did they even get audited?
The Fed. Yes. Well, people have been trying to audit the Fed, you know.
They're supposedly,
my point is, like, tools like Bulla make cheating much more difficult.
Of course. And that's the beautiful part of the blockchain.
Yeah. And that's where things need to head.
Yeah.
I think that asset prices will adjust because at the end of the day, what do you want? You want an asset that earns you the coin of the realm, whatever that coin is, right? And you don't want to be sitting on a bag of those coins because they could devalue overnight.
Well, yeah, I mean, if the coins of the realm are printed funny dollars,
you don't want those, right?
Yeah, you really don't want to be sitting on those.
In assets that can generate whatever the coin of the realm
is. You also want to be able to have a savings in the coin of the realm, which we can't have anymore.
Well, exactly.
How the government abuses them.
That's why you need, yes.
That's why Bitcoin is such an important tool, right?
100%, yes. And Bitcoin is hard money. It's hard. But it's not credit. If you like, you understand that I'm a credit guy, right?
No doubt.
And I'm probably, you know, for a lot of Bitcoiners, I'm anathema too, because a lot of them are 100% no fractional reserve, nothing, no credit. And I don't think the world can work that way because you need to.
I think there's a fine line between what it currently exists now and having the ability to stimulate and do some of those things. That being said, doing that with Bitcoin is a non-starter, I think. I think, Bitcoin is
Gresham's law. Gresham's law. Why are you going to spend your Bitcoin? I would never. I gave a guitar player in Costa Rica Bitcoin. I still regret it.
You had no idea what you gave him.
No, I didn't. I had it on my blue wallet.
Yeah. There. Oh, man.
Yeah.
That breaks my heart. But hopefully he knew what hopefully he's retired there in Costa Rica or whatever. Hopefully he held on to it. how do you see the current situation playing out, in the Middle East right now? Do you think we're going to continue there for a long time and have another 20-year war? Do you think this is going to wrap up in a couple weeks?
It's really hard to say, gosh. I tend to think Trump surprises everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you have a conventional view about things, you should be questioning that view. That said, there are things that there are inertia. There's a huge amounts of inertia in human beings and mm-hmm. how they operate. And it's not so easy to just decapitate the top and expect flowers, I guess. but I don't like what's happening in the world, but I also don't like that the Iranian regime is not focused on improving the lot of their own people, for God's sake. Are they? I don't know. Somebody,
it doesn't seem that way.
Okay, so we agree on that. Yeah. And if you agree on that, then you have to say to yourself, well, what is government really, what's the purpose of government? And if you're, Hayekian or somebody like me, you're going to be, it's to protect private property and everything else is not government.
Yeah. Right? I agree.
But here they are a theocracy. So they're trying to, they have the end of the world view and they have all these things that are to me kind of useless for living on this planet. So anyway, back to what I think will happen. I think Trump will surprise.
Yeah.
And it will be maybe not the best solution, but better than what
the status quo has been.
I also
funding all these different terror groups all over, from the Houthis and to the people in the Lebanon to the Hamas, to all these different.
We were just talking about waste. How wasteful has that been?
Yeah,
and I think that the Gulf states now are just starting to have maybe they're having a renaissance.
I think they are, for sure. I was in Dubai recently.
Okay.
It was unbelievable. I'm like, this is the future, right? There's so much potential and possibility,
It's very positive,
over there.
Right? Yeah. Very positive. Yeah. And I think that that will be the reinvention of, banking and credit. I was going to tell you a story. Double entry accounting it was a revolution.
Yep, no doubt.
Bulla is triple entry accounting, meaning that we're sharing a book, right, instead of two.
Yep. Well, that's what the blockchain is in general. It's triple entry accounting.
Triple entry. Yes.
That's the innovation, right?
And double entry accounting already made the renaissance because at the time, if you knew that they were doing double entry accounting, you didn't need to have your brother do the accounting.
Exactly.
You could have somebody audit it.
Yeah.
And
I think going back to the ancient, Sumerian clay tablets and stuff, that was single entry.
That was
the beginning of, a prosperous, and a lot of it had to do with money. It had to do with transactions. And that's why we got
property.
And the Renaissance, we got double entry bookkeeping, right? And then now we just recently, in the past two decades, we've gotten triple entry bookkeeping.
So I'm super bullish. I mean, I don't even care.
Are you bullish or are you bullish?
Bullish,
Oh, man.
Oh, I don't know. I think it'll work out. It doesn't make any sense for you to fight the kind of power that the United States has anyway. I mean, what are you, nuts? Look at these weapons that they have.
Yeah, people don't even understand, like, where you think all this tax money is going. At least a couple trillion a year has been going to the...
Yeah, I mean, some of it looks pretty...
You look what they did to Maduro over there. Oh, I mean, those people said that somebody came out with something and a weapon that just disseminated...
Right, they all, like, lost their consciousness.
These aliens, what's going on? Yeah, and I think, we've been so secretive about that for so long, but I think Trump is now starting to play some cards here. Yeah. He's trying to do, the world is being shaken up. It's being rewritten right now. We're going through a period of time, and it needed to happen in a lot of ways. Yeah. And I'm not, pro, I'm kind of in this wait and see mode. I don't know everything. Obviously I hate war. I hate the situation, with Iran and all this stuff, but I'm kind of let's see what happens. Yeah. I don't know what's going to happen. I know that if we do what we did in Afghanistan and Iraq we go and try to be there for 30 years and we fucking,
that was a disaster.
That's an absolute disaster. But if we can get in, take out these sites, get some concessions in our interest, in American interest, right? Open up that strait. If we can get some things like that and it's a quick situation where we don't lose, 5,000, 10,000 lives of people on the ground, it's a different story to me. And I think I'm kind of open-minded. I'm not, I'm kind of in this wait and see mode. I guess that's the way I look at it right now.
Yeah. Well, what can we
show me the money?
What can we do about it too?
Yeah, there's nothing you can do about it. Of course. Really? Yeah. Yeah. We're, the only thing we can do is,
vote.
I mean, was this a successful, term and period of time? And I think the jury's still out on that. We've got to give it a couple more years and see by the end of the term, are we happy with the results? Right.
Yeah.
Are we happy with, if Cuba becomes free? Maduro was taken down, was a good domino and a stabilizing force, in the South America now, where we don't have, our frenemies, or as we call them, Russia, Iran, et cetera, on our doorstep. And then if Cuba opens up and, the communism there falls and we've got a free society and travel and trade and, it could be a very good thing. Then we won't have so many people swimming across to get to Florida. Yeah. And then if the situation in the Middle East stabilizes, it feels like, and again, I'm not an expert, it just feels like Iran is the last hurdle to, a workable peace situation there.
Yeah.
Just because how they've been funding all the terror, it all is coming from them, from the Houthis to the Hamas, to all these different organizations. There's still issues, right, with Syria, and there's kind of a truce. It seems like a workable situation. The guy who's in charge now seems like he's, willing to play ball and negotiate, and he wants prosperity for his people. But, that remains to be seen because he's got a bad background. But it seems like there's people you can deal with and work with, right? Yeah. People. And that's what we've seen from, in a lot of other, Arab states over there. So it just feels like if this domino falls and we get something that's workable, something that's like, hey, you're not going to have nukes, just play ball. You can have prosperity. We'll reduce the sanctions. If we can get a workable situation there, I think the whole Middle East might really have a chance to have some, finally have some peace. But, what I like about Trump is everything's on the table. Yeah, he's not going by traditional rules.
Full throated.
Yeah. He's not fucking around. No. He's not when he says something and threats, you better,
you got to pay attention.
Yeah. You better pay attention, I guess is what I would say, because he's a wild card.
Yeah.
You can't just go back on what the current, military industrial complex has been doing for the past 100 years. It's a different ballgame.
Yeah.
So.
And he just doesn't, everything's unconventional pretty much. Yeah. He questions everything.
Yeah. Which I love. I love to see that.
Yeah. It needs a little more because the current system, if it continues without questioning things, we're going to blow up for sure.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, look at how many trillions of dollars we have in debt. We're probably going to go into recession now because of the war.
That's what I was. I mean, is that what you think would happen if this war continues? Do you think we go into recession because of the oil, or do you think if this resolves?
Well, we're going to have
What are your thoughts?
We'll have some shocks.
Okay.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
And I think the consumer is pretty tapped out as far as I can tell. I mean, retail sales, though, surprised the other day. Yeah. So
interesting.
Yeah. But then I always say, this is what I always like. It's like, well, Americans are maxing out their credit cards one last time. And you always hear that every time.
The credit limit goes up on that 10K.
But no, to me, they're burning.
The bubble keeps going.
But they're burning fiat.
Yeah.
You know, right? It's, like, you know. Wouldn't you? Why do you want to keep? What are you going to do? Other, they should be buying Bitcoin.
Yeah. But,
you know.
No doubt.
They haven't found it yet.
Hmm. Well, this has been a fascinating conversation, Mike. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Yeah, nice. Thank you.